Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are going to meet three people who were on the show in the very beginning of their career, some of them while they were running for their seats in the House of Delegates, and we talked to them as they were beginning the state session last term. And now we're going to talk to them about where we are. So much has happened. They finished their first session, introduced bills that many freshmen would not have done in their first year. They were out there in the streets during the uprising. They have a lot of ideas about where our city should go. They represent a new generation of political leaders and join us in studio. We're here with Delegate Brooke Learman. Brooke Learman is the 46th district, right?
46.
In the House of Delegates, Delegate Antonio Hayes, District 40.
Yes.
And we'll soon be joined by Delegate Corey McCray of the 45th. And Corey's running a tad late because he had to pay a visit to a friend whose mother passed away. So he's on his way to the studio, though. And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner, but call 410-319-8888. We're going to cover some of the issues we've been covering with the mayor and others, but with them. So first, you know, I was thinking about your campaigns. I know that Corey, he and I have talked about this a lot, did a door-to-door campaign in the old-fashioned way. But you two as well did that, didn't you?
We did.
I mean, you were kind of a shoot-other campaigns when you began.
Right. And for, and this is Antonio. Mark, for me, this wasn't my first time out.
Right.
You know, I ran in 2006 and came short, less than 100 votes. And there's some lessons that I learned from that. And, you know, part of it was, you know, just dedicating every time to come in contact with voters. This time, I would say there was a huge contrast in people's appetite to give someone new an opportunity to run. You know, in 06, a lot of the, you know, more senior residents of my district were more inclined to be supportive of someone who had already held office that, or was a lot more senior. But this time, people were really, really looking forward to a new type of energy, was encouraged by the fact that I was out knocking on their door. So I think that played a huge role in the success of this campaign.
Yeah, I agree. I encountered a similar. I hadn't run before, but certainly I had a very open reception from the vast, vast majority of people whose doors I knocked on. And I knocked personally on about 14,000 doors, and then our volunteers did an additional 20. I also, and another aspect of, and I think Antonio and Corey did this as well, another aspect of grassroots campaigning that I'm a big believer in is house parties and having, you know, small coffees and gatherings in people's homes, because you sometimes include people that maybe you wouldn't have knocked on their door because they weren't in your targeted list. And so you meet new people that way and you expand the electorate. And I think that, you know, we all are interested in expanding the number of people who vote and who are active here in Baltimore City. And so our campaigns were an effort to be overly inclusive and really draw new people out to the polls.
So why did you run in the first place?
Why did I run?
Yeah. I know Antonio's been wanting this for a while. He ran. He's been involved in politics an awful lot, serving with different politicians. Why did you run?
Well, I grew up in a household that really believed in the value of public service. I had always believed in public service, and I worked on campaigns. I did AmeriCorps Vista when I was out of college. And then I was working as a civil rights attorney in Baltimore City and doing a lot of pro bono work with the Community Law Center, representing neighborhoods that were trying to clean up their neighborhoods and make them better and cleaner and safer for families. In particular, I represented community groups all over the city that were trying to close down dangerous bars and liquor stores. And I got very frustrated at what I saw back then. And now we have a new liquor board, right? It's a new day at the liquor board. But
yes,
back
is.
Then, it was a very frustrating process. And after working with, you know, neighborhood after neighborhood, particularly I worked with a great group in Highland Town, I said, you know, I can do this one case at a time, or I can run for office and try to change the law and try to make a difference at the state level, because I started realizing how much the state affects our neighborhoods and our communities every day. And as a young mom, a young professional and community activist, I thought we really need, you know, I want to be able to fight for Baltimore City at the state level.
So let me just deal with some political issues, and you mentioned one right here. So the state senators appoint the liquor board. They say who they want to have represent their district on the liquor board.
Well, the governor appoints.
Right, but they
right, with usually, the suggestion
they can give
the
suggestions and recommendations.
Right, so it's always kind of been a political patronage job.
Yes.
Time, right? But do nothing, hang out, and just, you know, have fun and then collect your paycheck. It's a patronage gig. But then that changed when Judge Ward became the head of the liquor board and began to tighten things up and really pushed to have communities' voices heard
at
liquor hearings, which didn't happen before.
Right.
And now we see that that that's being challenged. He's being pushed.
He's leaving.
He's leaving.
Yeah.
And the governor says he's going to put in a whole new liquor board.
Yep.
He's already indicated that in his dispute with Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake that he wants to support giving money to the liquor stores who were burned out during the uprising to reopen as liquor stores. Mm-hmm. And so there seems to be this is a major not just the development business but also community issue and cultural issue that's about to explode here. So what do you all think about that and how do you deal with that?
I think, you know, I don't know that people always understand how important it is to have responsible businesses in our neighborhoods and what an impact one bad business can have on a neighborhood. I mean, you can have a neighborhood that's sort of teetering and it could go one way or the other and you have a bad bar on the corner and it just drives people away. So this really is an important issue. And I'm hopeful that Governor Hogan will recognize that it is pro-business and pro-neighborhood to have members of a liquor board that will uphold the law. Because, and I say that it's pro-business, and I mean that, because other businesses in a neighborhood suffer when there is a bad business, a bad liquor store there. And we saw that in Highlandtown with the neighborhood where I was representing. All the other businesses were suffering because there was this one bar that was really driving down the neighborhood. So you can be – it's a pro – we need a pro-business, you know, in terms of supporting responsible businesses and supporting communities. We need those types of people appointed to the liquor board.
So one of the things – let me welcome Corey McCray in. Corey, again, condolences to your friend. Family.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for coming in the midst of all that. I appreciate it.
Appreciate you, man.
410-319-8888 is the number here. One of the arguments raised yesterday, I want to hear your thoughts on the liquor stores in your communities and more. 410-319-8888 for our delegates here. But one of the arguments made yesterday by one of our panelists was that, look, these are businesses. Mm-hmm. These are people who put their sweat and blood into their businesses. They have a right to these businesses, and they have a right to be compensated to help them reopen their stores. And so this kind of leads to kind of a real confrontation or crossroads between that and what a community needs, what kind of businesses they want, and how you make that work. I'd like to pick it up from there.
Right. And Mark, this is Antonio again. One of the first pieces of legislation that I passed in this upcoming that I introduced and subsequently the governor signed into law was raising the fines for liquor establishments that sold alcohol to minors. Baltimore City has the lowest fine that can be imposed on a liquor establishment for serving alcohol to minors. And what I found in the research leading up to introducing this legislation, one would think with all of the bars and entertainment venues that you have in downtown in the harbor and all of the college students transcending in downtown that a large percentage of the violations of serving underage young people in our city came from parts of downtown. But the core, the highest concentration of those violations for serving to alcohol minors came from the core of East and West Baltimore, those neighborhoods that are really suffering, you know, on all different types of socioeconomic levels and really challenged with not having access to free, you know, fresh foods and other things that help build the community. And so, you know, I agree with Brooke in that, you know, I'm a huge supporter of small businesses and I've been working with, I think they're the lifeblood of many communities in Baltimore, especially at little corner stores. But there's 500 liquor licenses. There, for every 500 residents in Baltimore City, there's a liquor license in our city. And, you know, sometimes we need to step back and evaluate. Earlier we were talking about some of the things that need to happen in our city to turn the curve. That's not the single most issue, but that's part of the persistent problem that we've had going on in the city with so much access.
But the question is, and what do you do about that? I mean, I'm not a teetotaler, nor do I believe that prohibition was important.
I don't think any of us are. We all like to go get a beer on a Friday night.
Right. So how do you address that, Corey? What's the answer to that?
I think that the administration has a good program that
Which
they're trying to implement, the mayor's administration now, in reference to the amount of liquor stores. You have, just look at Milton and Biddle, where you had three liquor stores on one corner. Just look at North and College. Chester, you have three liquor stores within walking distance of 2 minutes. So as Antonio stated, the socioeconomic challenges from housing, those neighborhoods also have dilapidated housing, food deserts, poverty levels are close to 50%. These challenges are in concentrated neighborhoods that's within East and West Baltimore. So when you talk about the downtown and you talk about those that's opened up at 6 a.m., the first thing that the kid is saying is the liquor store that's opened up at 6 a.m., closing at 2 a.m. These organizations or these businesses have been eaten off of our neighborhoods for so long. We're just trying to say that we want better. And there's nothing wrong with saying that we want better. We want better organizations, businesses within those neighborhoods. It doesn't have to be three at once on one corner.
So how do you take a larger look at this? So how do you – we talked about this before we went on the air, so let me take a breath and think this thing through and say it correctly. So taking what you just said,
yep,
and what you all just said, we have a city – well, over half the people, or half the people, maybe less than half, depending on what you look at. We know there are 86,000 families that are home insecure in this town, which means that's probably close to half the people of Baltimore, which means that literally they live in poverty in this city, not being sure whether to pay the rent first, the water bill, your electric bill, transportation for your kids, food, what do you pay for? And people juggle that all the time, every day. As both that all of you know, and where you two grew up, you both know that existed around you all the time.
Absolutely.
Right? So, whenever we have development, our development is always in the center of the city, is in the places where mostly upper middle class and mostly upper middle class white people live, and where the Inner Harbor is, and the development doesn't take place outside. Back in 1983, when I helped run Billy Murphy's campaign, there was a disaster against William Donald Schaefer. One of the slogans we came up with in that day was, there's the Inner Harbor, but we never talk about the Outer Harbor, the people who live in the rest of the city. So what are some concrete ideas that work?
One of them is a functioning liquor board. And I think that we all know that Judge Tom Wood was doing a great job. And I personally know Dana Moore, and I know where their hearts are. I know that they are community organizers. I know that they're day in, day out. We have liquor stores or functioning businesses that don't hold true to the license that they hold. Having that operation from 6 a.m. to 2 a.m., you have to serve a certain amount of food. You have to why do you have the back gate to where you get to the food is always you got to be buzzed in, or it's a big dark screen and things like that, Mark. That's why we have to have that functional liquor board, and the people that serve on that liquor board is very, very important. We can have what we already had, or we can have the direction that we were going in.
Right. And to add on that, Mark, I think, you know, like we had this conversation earlier, and there's a lot of different issues. I think, you know, for expediency time sake and for sound bites, people are looking for that magic bullet to solve all the problems. But I think the issues that face our communities are far too complex. You know, whether it be addressing the issues on a liquor board, whether it's looking at real sustainable inclusionary housing policies, whether it's, you know, dealing with substance abuse in our communities, you know, opportunities for entrepreneurship as well as jobs. I've heard a lot of people, especially in the aftermath of the uprising, talk about giving people jobs. But, you know, talking to people in Park Heights and Penorth and Sandtown, Winchester, which all I represent, a lot of those people face a lot of policy hurdles, which, you know, some of us try to, you know, address in this past legislative session, and we still have a lot of work to do. But there's such a myriad of different things that's brought us to this issue. One of the things that the city council is grappling on, back to the liquor store issue, is a lot of those, there's 100 liquor stores that are non-conforming with our zoning right now. And it's, you know, it's challenging to understand why it's taking so long to deal with that issue. But I think across the board, there's so many different policy issues that could be addressed for these long-standing problems.
Yep, and I'd like to touch on one of the things that Antonio talked about, which was inclusionary housing policies.
Yeah,
okay. I think
I wrote that one down as he
yeah,
said.
Yeah, you know, you look at where we are, and you know, it's the basics: housing, schools, jobs, transit. Right? We're not going to police our way to a better Baltimore, because the underlying problems that give way to this are a lack of good housing, good safe housing in, you know, good neighborhoods, great schools, good jobs, and transit to get to those jobs. So housing, we can talk about inclusionary housing policies. The city has one of the has an incredibly weak, basically lifeless inclusionary housing policy. All we have to do is look down the road in 95 and see that Montgomery County has one of the best inclusionary housing policies in the country. Yes, we're different than Montgomery County, but we can do better and we should be doing better. We can also look at non-speculative housing ideas like community land trusts, schools. You know, we know what works in education. We know how to make better schools. We know we need effective principals and great teachers. Jobs. We are starting to rebuild our economy. We're working towards that. We need more jobs. We need apprenticeship programs like Corey, Delegate McCray talks about. We also need transit to get to those jobs. So right now, the highest percentage of people with commutes over 45 minutes is Sandtown Winchester. We need to be able to get – people need to be able to get to work.
And they take public transit for the
And they take public transit. And our bus system is dysfunctional, which is – that's sort of been my baby. I'm really working on MTA and our bus system and introduced a bill last session to create a board of directors for MTA that would totally – sort of, I hope, revolutionize how MTA functions. Because, you can build – we can create jobs and we have job centers, but they're not near where people live. And we have to get people – we have to reorient our entire public transit system to get people to jobs, to where they need to get.
So do we have to – is it time for a break or do we okay, let's do this. So let me read – we'll go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. First caller is Mimi, but join us, 410-319-8888. Have an email here from Rhonda. That's a question directly for Antonio Hayes. We'll come up with 410-319. Oh, Mimi just left. Folks, don't leave us. Phones are there. Come back. Come back. We'll get your calls. 410-319-8888. One of the things that when you talk about the issues that you think are important, how to turn things around, the question becomes, how do they happen? In other words, I was thinking about how people are dying for real work, and people are dying for real work in this town, can't get jobs. So, and we had these TIFs and pilots are always a big battle over whether or not to give wealthy corporations money to build something downtown. Mm-hmm. Let's say for argument's sake, you give them their TIFs and pilots. Mm-hmm. What do you get in return? So one of the things let me just throw this out.
We should be getting affordable units, but we're not.
We should be getting A, affordable units, but B, look to other cities, Cleveland. They created the Evergreen Co-ops.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yep. Where inner-city men and women who have been unemployed now own their own gigantic laundromat, employs hundreds of people. They own the business. They make the money. They have contracts with the hotels. They have contracts with the hospitals like Hopkins, and they're making it. So it gives hundreds of families a decent living, and you can build community. But you can't build community until people have jobs.
Yeah.
Right?
Mark, if I can just touch on one of the points. I think it is so important that we leverage the opportunities that come from the TIFs, the pilots. On a state level, it's the bond bills. Every developer that's we got a bond bill out of the 45th District, been having that conversation with them and talk about how construction is a path to middle class, how we need to leverage the apprenticeship slots. And I think that it's a good conversation that's happening with the Parkway Theater, with Barco, just with so many numerous businesses that have gotten bond bills and leveraging the power that we have on the state. So bringing in Delegate Maggie McIntosh into that conversation, Senator McFadden. And I just also wanted to touch on some of the policy. We talked about housing a little bit, and I sit on a housing subcommittee. And one of the things that we have as state leaders is we get to see policies set for all local jurisdictions. And one of the things that I truly remember is that when Baltimore County was going through their challenges and they didn't want to accept housing affordability, then when Anne Arundel County and the elected official out there was very blatant. If you can't live here, you don't need to be here. And that's not right. If you can't afford to be here, But I want to say a bill got brought in the way it would circumvent the state process, so we wouldn't have as much of a say when they're talking about affordable housing. But we stopped that right there. So we not only get to look at it from a city level, but across the state, looking at all these municipalities and how they can put in hurtful legislation, because what they're trying to do is push them all to the city. They're trying to push everything towards the city, and they wonder why we have the highest population of homeless children. They wonder why we spend more to educate our kids, because many of our kids might not have a computer in their home. They wonder why our poverty levels are at 50% or higher, because every other county is trying to push folks into the city.
Your thoughts at 410-319-8888. We do have to take a very quick break. We're going to come right back, and we'll come back to our other delegates and to Mimi on the phone and to read Rhonda's email, 410-319-8888, as we talk to the freshman delegates and their ideas of where we have to go. Mr. Sandman. Is that what we're playing? No, that's the wrong song. What song is this? Oh, that's this song. I'm sorry. On the way to break. How could I not know? Summertime, Lena Horne. Born on this day in 1917. We'll be right back.
Fish are jumping, and the cotton is high. Oh, yeah.
time you say you will when you won't. You tell me you do, baby, when you don't. Let me know, honey, how you feel. Tell the truth now, is love real? Uh-uh. Oh, honey, don't. Well, honey, don't.
Welcome back. Good to have you with us here. This is Mark Steiner, and we're coming back to our conversation here with our guests and our three freshman delegates, Corey McRae, Brooke Learman, and Antonio Hayes, 410-319-88. You might have to go right to the phones?
No.
410-319-8888. Mimi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Mimi. Good morning.
Good morning. Just briefly, all of these individual things, schools, housing, jobs, the police, it all comes from a source. And that is something that we have to recognize, not necessarily bomb them, but I said, that's it. And otherwise, it's just chasing, you know, chasing around. It closed one door and the other is going to open, or open one door and the other one's going to close. But I a couple of things. One, that this co-op and it's successful. And I believe that that is what, that's one of the things that can really help. When people get together and they have the skills, people are working, they're doing all the work. Have since slavery that the white society can't do, basically. So really, all the skills are there, except that the business part of it has been sort of knocked out of the community. That's my view of it. So to take that on, like the food, instead of waiting for Walmart and whoever, whatever those supermarkets are, to come in, is to open corner stores. It doesn't have to be just the stores that are there now. People can get together, and I have the expertise in how to do that, and I would love to share that. And it doesn't cost much at all to have a produce market, and people need to eat. They can't just wait until a farmer's market or go out of their community to get it, and we can do it ourselves.
I agree with me, man.
If there's anybody there who wants my number, I can give it. And I don't know if Mark has it, but I don't mind giving it on the air, actually.
We'll get it for you when we don't answer a lot of crank calls, but we'll get it. And you, when our producer will pick up and get your number, Mimi. And if it is the Mimi who I think it is, I do have your number. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying, you agree?
I agree with Mimi. I think that we can do it. I think that we can have strong businesses, mm-hmm. good partners within our community that
Absolutely.
Don't just sell
yeah,
liquor
no
doubt. And, yep. and things like that. So
and
I'm,
there are
I'm
many of them.
Yep.
I mean, they exist, you know, yep. that we just need to make sure we're strengthening them and replicating
yep.
them.
Yep.
Absolutely.
410-319-8888. We'll get to this call in line, too, in just a minute. And the other calls coming in at 410-319-8888. Hear your thoughts and ideas. We want to know what you're thinking out there. And Rhonda wrote in. Let me read this email that's directed to – let me get this email pulled up here. Directed to Antonio, but I guess it'd be all three of you. Antonio Hayes voted against an elected school board and had never been to a school board meeting. He knew that was a hot issue and still didn't go to school board meetings to see the ones that vote for a budget of millions of dollars after only reviewing it for 30 minutes, sent in by Rhonda. Antonio?
Yeah, so Rhonda is correct, Mark. I know Rhonda really well. She's very active in the community, has been, you know, a voice on a lot of issues. I voted against the school board legislation, the bill that came only for the city delegation because it was a bad bill. You know, in campaigning, people expressed to me that they're tired of politicians that you know, are only interested in quick sound bites or whatever. And looking at the legislation that created three members of the board, which would have made the board an even amount of members. There's 9 members on the board. So it would have given, you know, 12 members to the school board, which, you know, if there's ever a dispute amongst the school board members, there would have been a tie. The second part of it, I know a little bit about running for elected office. And to run for an elected office, it costs a substantial amount of money, especially the way the legislation was written. They will be running for citywide office. And I think the advocates that support elected school board, their reason for supporting elected school board is because they want a voice of the community. And I'm not interested in someone, you know, just buying a seat on the school board to represent, you know, not the voices that the advocates believe that they'll get. And so I'm not opposed to the idea of a hybrid elected school board, but the legislation that I voted for was a bad bill for Baltimore
against,
City.
I voted against was a bad bill. And Brooke, very quickly, I mean, you said during the break that you had.
Yeah, I also voted against it. I have concerns. Look, I think all three of us and every member of the city delegation can agree that there are real challenges and problems
Absolutely.
Facing Baltimore City Public Schools right now. I do not think that an elected school board is a panacea, right? It's not a fix-all.
No.
And I think that to blame the, you know, There are problems with the current school board. We had a very, very heated debate with members of the current school board over guns in schools issue, where, you know, me and other members of the delegation had very choice words with the school board. But I think that, you know, to paint this as sort of the reason that our schools are having problems is not correct. It's not a panacea. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. I'm certainly dedicated to working with the school board and with community activists to make sure that there's more transparency and that we can move forward together.
How did you vote?
I voted for it. I think that we need more access to the community. I think that the school board members, I would like to see them at a lot more community association meetings, more accessible to the community. And I think that that would happen with a partially elected school board.
And before we go to the phones and Bill, the next caller up, we have two tweets I want to read in here. Melissa writes in, the non-conforming liquor stores vary, though. We have two in my neighborhood. One is a good neighbor. The other is awful.
Yeah.
And Reverend Moses Moyes writes in, could some of these liquor stores be converted to grocery stores, bodegas? How can communities make that happen?
I mean, I think that's a great idea and would be the ideal. You know, I mean, I don't think the mayor, I can't speak for the mayor, but, you know, I don't think she wants to put people out of business. You know, none of us want to be putting people who are good business folks out of business. What we want is to make sure that our communities have the resources that they need and that not every community has, you know, a surplus of liquor stores, that there are other options, that there are grocers, that there are, you know, little stores where you can buy things for your house, for, you know, anything that any community would want. And we want, you know, restaurants, just straight up nice little corner restaurants. I mean, there are so many little restaurants in my district that really, you know, it's great to have them on the corner. They're not mm-hmm. bad liquor stores. They're not bad neighbors. They actually create community.
But can you create, and we'll come back to the school board. I have two school board comments here. So we'll come back to that. Then I want to really switch gears, at least for the last 15 minutes or so, talk about some other issues. But can you, in an economically depressed community, have restaurants, have cleaners, have places that can survive, in poor neighborhoods? Let's talk. I mean,
so one of the common things I keep on hearing, everybody say that it's not the one fix all. I think that we know that jobs, we know that housing, but in that point, it's important the wage that a person makes, which is why the city and the state has the leverage in reference to city residents, better wages for the people that occupy in our communities.
So let me go to the phones here, and then we'll switch topics. Again, tweeted in, it isn't the reason, quote-unquote, the reason schools have problems, but it's a, quote-unquote, problem. The school board is disrespectful to parents' community. 410-319-8888. Bill, you're on the air.
Yes, first let me just say hello to everybody.
Good morning.
And, of course, let me say congratulations to the school delegate.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
This is Bill Good. Now, let me just set my problem with the elected school board. I'm for elected school board, and I think it's a lot more than the activists just having a voice on the school board. It's no different than running for political office. Yes, you want a voice, but you also want to create change. You know, when we were fighting for a civilian review board, did we get what we want?
No.
No, we did get a civilian review board, but it don't have the type of power that we're supposed to fight for. But, you know, so the people that was advocating and people that's advocating for a partial elected school board is to at least give a challenge to the people that's appointed to the school board who answer to the political people that appoint down there. So, you know, so, I mean, I'm just saying all that to say, I think that when you weigh it out, don't you think that we need an elected school board?
I think that there definitely need to be some changes, Bill, but I don't see anyone raising $100,000 to get elected to a school board for a volunteer job. And that was what the legislation called for, some volunteers to, you know, engage in a political campaign to come on a school board. And I don't think that's what you or I want. Obviously, you know, we all want some changes in the way the school board communicates with communities and parents and teachers or whatever, and we're working on some of those systemic changes. I don't think that this legislation would have solved the problem that we're having.
Yes.
I think it's a really difficult question, but and I think that there's some solutions that people – we have to wrestle with, whether it is an elected school board, a combination of elected school board, but some accountability.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I think we all agree 100%.
We're closing schools like Langston Hughes that is a powerful community school that wraps their arms around their children, and we're going to close that school.
Well, we're closing Westside Elementary School, my alma mater. I mean, you know.
And we closed mine, Garrison Junior High School,
There's definitely some issues there. I mean, and so I'm one of the biggest critics of the school system on different levels. And Bill and Rhonda raise both very, very important issues. But the elected school board and this legislation that was introduced was not the answer to it.
Oh, Bill just left us. I'm going to get to Bill. Bill, why are you dropping off, folks? We're going to come to you. Come on back here. I love the people calling. All of a sudden, you're gone. 410-319-8888. Join us here. But let me when somebody raised the issue of a police civilian review board, mm-hmm. we have some serious issues here in this community around police and policing. And violence inside community, both. They're a double-edged sword that's hurting a lot of people. So, I always thought that maybe the House delegates and State Senate could use its own conversation about race and racism among the delegates and senators to kind of wrestle with it themselves, because people mm-hmm. don't, it's a difficult thing to deal with. A lot of your fellow delegates and senators would not want to wrestle with it.
And sexism.
And sexism as well. But here we have a situation where we have a civilian review board with no teeth, where you've got a police commissioner and the mayor, both saying on the station that they didn't give the order to stand down. Who's running the show in the police department and in the city? When both the mayor and the police commissioner say, we didn't tell police not to respond. So who did? I mean, what happened? Mm-hmm. And, you know, people saying that the kind of targeting of young people in the city and filling up our jails. Now policemen clearly are standing down. You talk to their commanders, and they all say officers are reluctant to do anything. They're afraid, or quote-unquote afraid, to being arrested themselves and indicted. And you see every day people who have been kind of brutalized by police and impolite behavior. So what do you do? You three are new community leaders. Yeah. You have to be in the middle of this. What do you say? What do you do to change it? Yeah. What are the answers you think that exist?
Right. I'm not sure we have all of the answers, but one of the things I was fortunate enough most recently to get appointed to the public safety work group that both the Senate and the House have a joint committee on. And July the 23rd will be the first opportunity that we have to hear directly from people in the community. And so I would encourage anyone who's been an advocate in this issue to participate in it. But I think out of this work group, will reveals a lot of things. Some of the legislation that was passed that was introduced this past legislation that wasn't necessarily successful. Some of the because of vetoes or for whatever reasons that it may not have been successful. But there's a lot of advocacy groups and people in the community who are standing up and offering viable solutions. And so hopefully that we'll narrow down some priorities based off of some of the community input in this upcoming joint committee here.
One of the things that I always do is every interaction that we have in reference to in the community, I make sure that we have representation from the mm-hmm. police department. It starts with making sure that the community and the police department have a relationship, so that has to exist. The explorers, making sure that we're reaching out young children at a young age. So I know that Officer Banks, I know that so many of the officers within Northeast Eastern are taking the time out to connect with our young folks. And then we also have a new director of the Wage Commission and the Civil Rights Department for the City of Baltimore, Keisha Brown, and having those conversations with Keisha and making sure that when she's talking about who's going to fill a seat on a civilian review board, that Northeast is represented properly, East Baltimore is represented properly, and having and making that change where we can. So the small things and the small positions, trying to make sure that it can happen.
But to push a little bit, go ahead, Brooke. I mean, because I think I think with all due respect, because I respect you and all your work, Corey, I think we are beyond the point now where we can wait for small changes.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is so huge what we're facing here that what happened in Baltimore has erupted across the nation and become a symbol of what's going on. The question is, what do we do to really, in some revolutionary sense, change the dynamic that exists in this town, if maybe it can't be changed?
I mean, we had 9 shootings yesterday. It's incredible to think about. It's incredible. It's totally unacceptable. And, you know, I look at – I think that we, you know, we can look at some of the models that we – model programs we have in the city and look at what works and really start to build on some of those. So one that I like to highlight that not everybody knows about is the Inner Harbor Project, which is an amazing organization that brings students – you know, it used to be that the Inner Harbor had a huge amount – there was a lot of friction between store owners and young teenagers or teenagers and police. And what happened was this group came together, the Inner Harbor Project, Celia Neustadt started it – I think she's a city grad, or maybe she's a poly grad. I'm going to get in trouble.
Don't go there. You're not
trouble.
Sure.
I would I'm not gonna go get there. In trouble. She, you know, she worked with students, recruiting students from area high schools to come be in as peace ambassadors in the Inner Harbor, and gave them and worked with the police. Last year, there was a 75% reduction in crime in the Inner Harbor. The store owners love it. The police love it. And it's just building these huge and amazing bonds between community members and police. One other example, in the Southern District in my area, the day after the rioting on April 27th, I went down to the Southern District headquarters. We had people of faith there and the police officers. And we all gathered and prayed before the police officers went out. And faith leaders and the community members went out every shift change during the week to pray with the police officers. That sort of dedication by the community and working community and police officers together, working together and building relationships, I think that's what that's one of the things that can help.
Well, let me throw this out to you all and see what you think. Let me give you another example of the things that work. Something called Safe Streets.
Safe Streets is in right. Cherry Hill. It's hugely successful.
In all the areas, in all the precincts where Safe Streets works, there has not been one murder.
Yep.
At least
we got Safe Streets in my neighborhood, too, and that ain't true.
Well, it's true in McKelvey Park. There's not been one murder in that period of time since the 27th to now in McKelvey Park.
The 27th of what?
Of when?
April.
No, that's not true. There was just shooting right there on Monument Street, right there in the middle of the – in a daylight.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
But that could be true, but what I'm saying is, Corey, is that the stats we used when they were on the show just a couple of weeks ago showed that in the Cherry Hill and in McKelvey Park and in Park Heights, in the three small areas of those communities where they patrolled and worked, there were no killings and there was one shooting. So, which is remarkable in neighborhoods that are known for their violence. So the question I have to throw that out is that and I said what I just said was a stat we used several weeks ago when they were on, so maybe it's changed since then. However, should more money be put there, and maybe even from the police budget,
going into those
communities where that kind of violence can be ameliorated at the heart of it, and let police actually do the job they're supposed to do on the outside of that.
Right. I mean, that's what I'm sort of saying is that we have models of programs that work, whether it's the Inner Harbor Project or Safe Streets or, you know, there are other examples out there where I think we need to be looking at those models and doing what we can to replicate them and expand them. Certainly in Cherry Hill, you know, Safe Streets has been incredibly successful. And, you know, the people who are involved, the leaders who are involved with it are, you know, they're truly leading and transforming the community. It's a wonderful program.
Right. And when Brooke mentioned, Mark, earlier in the Harbor Project and you asked that question, Safe Streets automatically came to mind. I went with a delegation to Chicago that first brought Safe Streets here to Baltimore. And the success of that program is really because they are people, the violence interrupters or whoever, who are part of the community who are making real change and changing the course of violence in their neighborhoods versus, you know, some government entity. Obviously, it's an RFP process that's put out by the health department or whatever, but it's totally separate from law enforcement. And so I think we spoke a little bit to this earlier. Law enforcement is not necessarily always the answer. Obviously, they need strong partners in the community to be on board as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm represent the East Side, and we have Safe Streets East. So Safe Streets is a wonderful program. One of the things that we have to make sure, though, is that they have the funding to be able to do their job effectively also. And one of the things we also have to do is have complementary models such as job programs, the cleanliness within our neighborhoods, the education model to be able to complement the work that Safe Streets is doing.
Folks, 410-319-8888 is the number here. Again, Melissa tweeted again. Let me read her tweet in one more time. School board allows only 30 minutes for public comment every 2 weeks. 10 people at three minutes each. There's no other forum. I suspect supported the elected school board as a way to do something, anything to improve parent community engagement. And the only way that people can sign up to speak to the school board is between 4 and 5 p.m. And how can working parents actually do that?
I have a real concerns about that, I will say. As a working parent, you know, I can't really – it's certainly – I have trouble making it to school board meetings, and I can imagine that any – you know, that other people do as well. That's definitely something – increasing accountability – increasing the ability of parents to give feedback and to talk with school board members is definitely something that we should be focusing on.
Clarence emails in, those same counties – talking about things which you talked about earlier, Corey – those same counties have no problem with their residents working in Baltimore taking earned incomes out of the city. City Hall seems to not have a problem with it either. Baltimore City functions as a place where the lion's share of salaries are taken out to support other communities.
We need to put Baltimore City residents first. I honestly believe, like, if you have a take-home call, you make $100,000 with the police department. I don't see why you shouldn't live in a city. I think that we should have local hiring laws that help out those communities that's struggling with 50% poverty but have $2 billion worth of development going on in it. So I couldn't remember the emailer's name, but
Clarence.
I 100% agree with Clarence, man. You got to leverage these opportunities for our residents within our city of Baltimore.
So folks, join us here, 410-319-8888. These are folks who are the new young leaders of our community, elected to the House of Delegates. About to go into their second term, not second term, but second session in their first term.
6 months. We have a few months to go there.
6 months. I've only been elected for 6 months.
So we just passed the 1 year anniversary of the primary, and but we've only actually technically been in office since January.
Right, and we've only been back in Baltimore here for what?
Since
3 months. So,
yeah.
You know, the moment we were sworn in, we were stuck in Annapolis.
But you were out there in the streets.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
All the time
during the
uprising.
But it's amazing to think back how short of a time period has been all that's happening.
I know. It's incredible. Yeah. So much has happened since the end of session. Yeah. It feels like it was much longer ago than it was.
Yeah. So did this first session, before I try getting the call in here too, did this session meet your expectations? How does that affect your thinking going into the next year?
It was definitely eye-opening. There were so many new members. I think it was eye-opening for everybody, new and old members, new and veteran members alike, because there were, you know, what we had over 60 new members in the House of Delegates. Yeah. And so for some of us, for the first week, it was just getting our offices functional. You know, for me, it was figuring out where my committee room was. But it was fascinating. I mean, I'm on the Budget Committee, on the Appropriations Committee, and that was certainly a big focal point this session. And it was fascinating and important to learn about the budget process, because only by learning and understanding the process can you be an effective advocate. So I spent a lot of time learning and understanding and talking to people and building relationships. I also introduced a few bills, but a lot of my focus was on the budget this year.
I think anyone from, you know, that dealt with the legislature this past session would say that the influx of new members definitely changed dynamics on all different levels.
Yep.
This session. And I think, you know, it's a great testament to what Marylanders are thinking as far as their elected officials. There were some candidates from all over the state who never held elected office but have been doing the labor in their communities to represent them. I serve on a Health and Government Operations Committee. We deal with, you know, a lot of issues dealing with health policy, but the government operations part of that committee is kind of a catchment for everything. One of the things that I'm looking forward to coming up to in these next 3 years is working on the state procurement laws, allowing other opportunities for small and minority businesses to be a part of the state procurement system.
Mark, I think it was first humbling experience, yes, just to have the opportunity to serve. The second, I think it was a great learning experience, get to meet the colleagues, get to function within the committee. But I also think that all three of us hit the ground running. And one of the things that I think about, I amplified the conversation on apprenticeships and apprenticeship opportunities for our young men and young women. Getting a voting rights bill for ex-felons passed through the legislature and the House and the Senate was very, very important. And getting to work on rail safety was also so important. And one of the things was trying to put that balance of not only learning Annapolis, but bringing the message back to our communities, especially during sessions. So I know that I did conversations with Corey. Brooke did breakfast with Brooke. Tony did delegate in the district. But trying to make sure that communication that we want to see, be the people, be that change that you want to see in the district, and try your best to lead by example and just work very hard for this constituency. What's about Baltimore City?
We had a tweet in. We can close out with this a little bit. Housing Policy Watch tweeted in, so many communities have had zero investment, and some have had so much. focus on the zero investment neighborhoods now.
Yes.
So one of the communities that I would uplift is Penn North. It's a community that I grew up in, a community that my aunt is still, you know, president of the community association. It's the site of the CVS on the corner of Pennsylvania and North Avenue. And, you know, I see and starting to see a lot of speculators come to the community as of late. But, you know, not to go back to the school system one more time, but one of the most disheartening things to me is that's one of the schools that's going to close. And so it's the only elementary school in, you know, in that community and a viable anchor. But then you see marginal signs of progress being made along Pennsylvania Avenue with affordable housing.
We can't let that school close. Somehow it has to not close. Rick, we have 2 minutes left. So some final thoughts.
Quick. I mean, I think I agree. We need to be looking at best models for community development all over the all over the city. And we need to be using the 21st Century Schools Plan where we are opening schools and renovating schools. Like in Cherry Hill, we're going to have two new schools. There hasn't been any development there in years. So making sure that we're using that as a catalyst for further development and investment is important as we move forward.
Corey, one of the things is that first, I'd just like to thank you for this opportunity to amplify the conversations, for conversations that don't truly exist all the time at this medium. Yep. But if you are trying to follow anything that I'm doing, just please check out letcoreymcrae.com or Facebook at Delegate Corey McRae and try to communicate very, very effectively, letting folks know what we do.
Yep.
Well, we'll continue to have you all on over the summer and see how things are growing and what you're thinking as we get closer to the session. If we do this conversation, which you should, about if there's no red line, then what? It's a conversation
yes.
we also need to have.
We do need to have that conversation. Yes. We need to get...
We didn't talk about that today, did we?
No, we didn't.
Cancel
not.
The next hour. No, I'm just kidding. How do we do that and not have that conversation?
Yeah. We'll thousands of jobs lost.
Thousands of jobs.
So we will talk about that. Maybe in the next week we'll have that conversation and bring you all on to kind of wrestle with that, because I think it's important to do that. So I want to thank the three of you. Delegate Corey McRae, District 45, Delegate Brooke Learman, District 46, and Delegate Antonio Hayes, District 40, first-termers representing the Baltimore City of Baltimore. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
On the way to break, Mr. Sandman, Chet Atkins, passed away on this day in 2001. We'll be right back with a different conversation about taking off on the Supreme Court decision, allowing same-sex marriage and beyond. Stay with us. We'll be right back.